Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.
Going to be speaking to Oliver Wakeman about his new track, Why Do You Hate Me, from his album, from his Dark Fables album. Sorry, from the Tales by the Gaslight Dark Fables album. Get there eventually, you know. Bit of a busy news day, you know. I knew you'd act like this. You people always do. I'm low and I'm loved by a man from above who brought me to. I didn't choose to be the creature you see before you.
You love me, you're my above me. You just need love to keep me sane.
Ooh, nice big bass line at the end there. Why do you hate me? Clive Nolan and Oliver Wakeman, delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK. We'll find out in a minute. Oliver himself. Oliver, good afternoon to you.
Oh, good afternoon. Nice to be here.
Good to have you with us. Whereabouts are you currently residing in as we have this chat?
Currently in a not very sunny Cheltenham in the UK. So sort of between London and Cardiff, I suppose, if you were going to go as the crow flies.
I think we've got a lot of horse race fanatics out there, so I think that people will know. And of course, the Literary Festival, of course, because we're all highly skilled and literary people here at this time of the afternoon.
Absolutely, indeed, yes.
So tell me a little bit about the band and how you got into music, if that isn't too much of a leading question.
I'll try and give you the potted history, because it's quite long. Essentially, I mean, you may recognise from the surname that I come from a musical family, which is my father's Rick Wakeman. So I was born into a world of keyboards and silliness, I think is probably the best way of putting it. And I kind of inherited that need to play the piano. So I started off, actually at the age of four, very first time I played a piano, I walked into the lounge, we had a big grand piano, and I put my hands on the keys. And somehow, magically, I hit four notes that all sounded perfect together. And I went, oh, this is brilliant. Love this. So I thought, brilliant. That's great. I could play the piano. Then I did it again. And then obviously it sounded dreadful. And then I spent the next couple of weeks trying to do it. And it always sounded dreadful. Now, I remember going to my mum and said, oh, I think I'm going to have to learn to play piano. So I started doing lessons. And then I did the usual thing. When people become teenagers, they stop lessons because they don't want to be told about things. And I went off and started playing football, and I joined bands full of people that were much older than me and playing in pubs where I shouldn't have been playing at the age that I was, going to school, finishing school, jumping in a transit van, playing till late, coming back half cut and tired, and then getting back into my school lessons the next day. And I just love it. I love that camaraderie between musicians. I love playing in front of people, and I love the variety that writing music brings. It's just, everything's a new discovery every time you start.
Do you think it's an important part of any musicians? Because we live in an age where we have singer-songwriters who sit in their bedrooms and you know, drop a brick in a bucket and then sample it 500 times and they put it on YouTube, and the next thing you know, they're appearing on something. Or they go through that, you know, the dreaded TV reality, you know, the X Factor, and they become instant celebrities without doing the groundwork.
It's really tricky, isn't it? Because this day and age, that media hit that you get is terrific, because it exposes you to an audience that you would never, ever get otherwise. But I've always been a big fan of the graft, because I think it's like any job you learn. My dad always said to me, he'd always say, music is the world's longest apprenticeship. You never know everything. You are always learning. You never get to a point where you go, right, that's it, I'm a brilliant musician now. Because there's always something to learn. And I sort of think, you know, if you go through those programs, you hit a height very early in your life. And I sort of think everything from there, it's very difficult to maintain that level of audience level. You know, primetime TV, big audience thing is tricky to maintain. But I never got that opportunity. But then I don't know whether I ever would have wanted to, because I enjoy the playing in small clubs, getting out. I mean, I play with bands, duos, on my own with a piano, full rock bands around the world. It's just part of the job for me. I love it. So I think having that ability to be in charge of what you do is really important. And, you know, at the end of the day, writing music, to me, it's a craft. It's like a woodcarver carving an owl out of a piece of wood. That's what the job is creating something.
When you're creating something, I mean, how much have you had to, I mean, I suppose everybody's different, but how much have you had to absolutely underline that, you know, this is your own stamp and go your own direction? Because it would have been very easy for you to say, right, I'm not going to do anything of, you know, that dad did. So I'm going to do 3-minute punk songs and, you know, and stick it to them.
I think I did a little bit of that when I was younger, because we used to drive around with my dad and we used to put on the records that I was into at the time. So there's been many occasions where my dad's come to pick us up for the weekend and I've made him listen to Adam and the Ants in the car. So I did all that when I was younger, you know. Oh, you'll love this, Dad. And he's like going, oh, God. And I have the same thing now with my son constantly trying to play me stuff off YouTube. But I think there's I've forgotten the question.
Just saying, I mean, how difficult did you develop your own style rather than the, because there have been famous, you know, sons of famous people who've gone on to record albums, and you think, yeah, okay, they're kind of not really riding on the coattails a little bit.
It's tricky. If you're going to become a piano player and your father's a world-renowned piano player and keyboard player, you can't help getting some comparisons. I come from an environment where I enjoy the music with a little bit of complexity, and isn't just your standard songs. But then again, I write everything from an acoustic guitar ballad through to an orchestral piece through to a full-on rock opera piece of music. I've always been of the opinion that you do write a song, but it's almost channeled through you. You actually start writing and the song kind of grabs you by the scruff of the neck and won't let you go until you've got to the end of it. Like the song you just played, Why Do You Hate Me, was like that. It was from a section in the book that I was read, which that song is based on the book Frankenstein, which is about the argument between the monster and the doctor that created him, which is why the line, Why Do You Hate Me, comes from, because the doctor disowns this creation and the monster can't understand it. And there was a message in there, something that was written 150 years ago, which was our basic emotional need to be wanted and loved. And that feeling of rejection is something that everybody's gone through, whether you're whatever, you know, group you come from, whatever lifestyle you come from, everybody's have that feeling. And so for me, songs are often little moments of emotional torment or emotional feelings captured in a little bit of a story. And so to me, it just felt natural to write that way. And if, you know, people think, oh, he writes stuff a bit like his dad, I sort of can't help that. It's not done deliberately. I don't sit down and listen to a ton of his songs and go, right, okay, now what can I write that's sort of magpied half of these bits? It just comes. It's not deliberate at all.
So tell me about this particular project then. I mean, give me some background about, you know, tell me about obviously Clive as well and how you guys get together and how you guys work.
Well, the record that you've just played there is a single from a box set called Tales by Gaslight. And it's a box set of some work that we did 20 years ago. And we released these albums in 1999 and 2002. The first one was called Jabberwocky, which was based on the Nonsense Poem. The second one was Hound of the Baskervilles, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle story. And then they went out, they did very well, sold very well. And then as things happened, they went out of print. And I kept seeing them for sale on eBay, like for 100-odd quid. And it was just like people were writing to me saying, I really want to buy the album. I don't just want to listen to the fact that somebody's ripped it off and put it on YouTube. I'd like to own it. And
that begs the question, isn't that a very sort of dangerous thing, going onto eBay and seeing how much your stuff's selling for? Because it could really crush your soul if they were saying, you know, get two for one.
It would be really bad, wouldn't it? It's the equivalent of the bargain.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's like walking into Woolworths, yeah. The old thing. No, so luckily somebody wrote to me and said, you've got to have a look at this. And it was like, oh, okay then. No, I don't troll the internet just looking for things of my own. But I sort of thought, do you know what? These albums are out of print now. It'd be nice to do something with them. So I spoke to Clive and said, look, should we re-release them? And I did a record. I toured with Yes from between 2008 to 2011. And we wrote some music in that period. And that music only got released in 2019 in a box set. And the management company, the Yes management company that did that, then came to me and said, have you got anything else? And I said, well, I've got these two albums that are based on these novels. And they said, well, how about, have you got any new music? And we had started writing a third record, which we'd never finished. So we went back through the folders and found a load of music. And we thought we had like maybe 5-10 minutes worth. We found we had 40 minutes worth of music. So as we were all in lockdown, we called up some friends and said, you know, do you want to play on this new record? And we basically pulled it all together in lockdown and sort of made a nice box set of our collected work that we'd done together. So that's really the history of where it came from. And it's been great fun to do it.
And what's it like revisiting stuff that you'd written, you know, a couple of years before or a couple of decades before even?
It's really interesting, actually, because you pick up some stuff and you can hear some of it and you go, oh, okay, I can see why I never did anything with this. But then you hear other bits and you go, actually, there's something really interesting there that I hadn't maybe picked up on at the time. Because when you're writing something, I mean, I write a lot of music. I've done about 300-odd pieces now. And I'm quite an intricate piano player. And so when you write a piece of music, sometimes you'll sit at the piano and play something and you'll go, oh, that's just the same as I've done before, or that's just that to that, or that sounds like that. And so you're more in the moment of thinking, actually, it sounds like something else. And then when you leave it for a long time and come back to it, you forget all that theoretical brain stuff, and you just listen to it and go, that's a nice melody. And then you pick it up again. And that's really what happened with these. There were lots of things in there that I suddenly thought, well, that's really good. And some bits were just ideas and it was finishing them off. Other bits actually needed some vocals on top. Other bits needed full arrangements. Other bits were pretty much as they were finished. And also, I'm not a great one for just putting an album together and just shoving whatever I've written around on it at the time. To me, an album has to have a kind of collective feel to it. So some pieces were there that just had never found another home.
Well, I mean, you said you've got the Frankenstein track, you've got the Hound of the Baskervilles, there's Jabberwocky. There's definitely some literature going on there, isn't there? Let's face it.
There is, isn't there? Yeah, it's definitely our literature work. I mean, that was when we first started working together. We said we did want to do an album based on a novel, and we couldn't work out whether to do Sherlock Holmes or Jabberwocky. There were two that we really wanted to do. And we were really lucky. Clive said to me, he said, oh, would your dad play on the record? And I thought, do you know, I don't really want him to play keyboards on a record because we both play keyboards. It just sounds a bit trite. So I said, well, why don't we get him to be the narrator? So he read the poem throughout the story. We made up a story to do with this poem. And then he comes in and reads the poem, which was great, you know. And then when we got to do Hound of the Baskervilles, I was friendly with Robert Powell, the actor. And he said, he was chatting to me one day, and I said, I'd love to do some narration if you ever need anybody for an album. And I said, well, I'm doing Hound of the Baskervilles. And he went, oh, I'll do it. He said, what do you want me to do? And I said, well, we need somebody to narrate and be Dr. Watson. He said, yep, I'll do it that way. And I said, you're very keen. I mean, you know, I haven't even told you how little money we have at the moment. And he said, no. He said, I've been Sherlock Holmes on the stage. This way I get to be Dr. Watson. I'll be the only actor that's done both parts. So that was his, you know, main reason to do it. So yeah, so he came in and did a fantastic job reading the book. And then we interplayed the music, and we just sort of felt that we were pretty good at writing in this sort of way. And so, you know, so we did, that's why we started the third one.
And I mean, talking about your father doing the narration, have you ever seen the Yes induction to the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and the speech he gave there? It's just gone on into legend, that one.
I've seen bits of it. To be honest with you, I've heard a lot of his stories.
I can't play most of it out, some of it out, because we are even though you're supping on looks like I've got a cracking cup of tea, we're not up to 6 o'clock yet in Spain, so I'll leave that one out. But again, we talk about, we have been in quote unquote interesting times over the past 12, 13, 14 months, whatever it is, wherever you happen to be on the planet. In a certain way for musicians, this has been, I mean, you know, a lot of people say, I'm going to write the great American novel and I'm going to do my rock opera in 15 parts. But, you know, for musicians, I suppose it was, we've got to be quite thankful that this has happened at this time in our evolution. And we've got these technologies that I can talk to you on Zoom or whatever, or however we want to do it. Whereas had it happened in the 60s for Fend, I mean, we wouldn't have been able to talk to each other, or you wouldn't be able to send files to each other.
No, it would have been unbelievably difficult. I think you're absolutely right. The fact that we have technology at the moment to help us through it has made it infinitely more bearable than I think it would have been. It's tough enough all being, you know, cooped up is kind of sounds slightly unfair when you're sort of trapped with your loved ones. But, you know, we all, as humans, we love variety. We do things. That's what we thrive off of, going to different places, getting new experiences. So when you have the same environment around you all the time, you have to find other ways of keeping your brain active. And I mean, for musicians, having all the technology that we have here and people able to record stuff at home, I mean, it's, to be honest with you, when you're working with another musician and they're recording, usually in a studio, you are looking at them through a piece of glass anyway. You're just staring at them through a glass, or sometimes you're on a monitor in a studio and they're in another room. So it's not massively different. It's just you don't go to the pub afterwards.
I may use that in a promo, by the way. That sounds, you know, the musician's life. But I mean, talking to, but a lot of people have said, right, we can do this project. I mean, I spoke to Stephen Perkins over in Los Angeles. He said, dropping a name, for the drummer in Jane's Addiction, ka-chunk. And then he was saying it was great because he was able to do classes and this and that and get, and you had two ways of doing this. Just like literally bolt yourself in and go on a Netflix binge, or just get on with it.
And I think, you know, for some people that Netflix binge was what helped them through it. And I'd never sort of, you know, I know lots of people that have just done that, and their challenge has been to consume as much as humanly possible, because they were never, ever going to get that moment to just see so much variety of stuff. And then people like myself that want to create, it's you just create. You do everything you can to do as much as you can, and some of it will work, some of it won't work. But, you know, I sort of think, you know, without the people that want to consume, there's no point in people creating. You know, you have to have both sides of the coin, as it were. But for me, I mean, even before lockdown, I'm dreadful at sitting around doing nothing. I'm always doing stuff. I find it really difficult to sit down and watch a whole film, because I'll always just want to get up and do something, or sit and play the piano, or pick up a guitar, or write a lyric, or do something. I have to always be doing something. So lockdown has just been an extension of that, with just a little bit more time.
Isn't that one of the things about it, being a quote-unquote creative, is that the fact you do get influences from all around the place? You're saying about literature, but, you know, watching a movie, you suddenly think, that's a really good idea for a lyric, and you suddenly, you know, pause the film and you just rip it off.
It's true. I mean, I did, as a track I wrote about 2013, I wrote an album with Gordon Giltrap, who's in the UK, a very well-known guitarist, wrote the track Heart Song, which is a bit of a sort of classic track. And in fact, I think it was used for the theme tune for The Holiday Show many years ago. And I wrote, on that album, we did a track called Credit Carnival, which was all about people betting money they didn't have in casinos. And all the lyrics for that were written when I was on tour with Yes, and we played a lot of casinos. And I would finish the show and just walk around the casino. And I never gambled in any of these places. I would just walk around and watch all the different people. And you could see the people that had loads of money and it didn't match. And you could see the people that were just doing it for a bit of fun. And you could see the people that were just desperate for that coin to drop, because it was all they had. And they were just, you know, winging everything on that one coin changing their life. And I just started writing lyrics just about that. And that stayed in my phone for like 3 years until the idea for that, the music for that song came. And that's what it is. You magpie life. It's a bit like the old thing of people watching. You just get something, and then a line will come to you. And sometimes a whole piece of music will just be built from that one line. You just start and you go, oh, here we go. And they keep tumbling out of you, and you suddenly end up with a framework of a piece of music, and you go, well, I can't leave it now. It's 80% there. And then you do the crafting bit. That's when you do the, you know, the fine tuning. But you never quite know. I mean, it's easier nowadays when you've got voice recorders on your phone. Whenever I'm walking around, I get an idea, you sing a little line in. And in the old days, you know, I remember you used to phone up your answering machine. You'd be out and you'd phone up your answer machine, wait for the ding to go, and sing to yourself for 10 minutes.
Did you never have a dictaphone or like that thing on the Walkman? On the Walkman, yeah. You could perhaps record, and then you'd, you know.
Had all of those, yeah. But you just use anything you can. I mean, I don't think I ever got to the point of phoning up my mum and saying, I'm going to sing you something, try and remember it. I don't think I've got quite that far. But it's, these things get you. You just have to find a way. And I love those things, because I still go through my old, you know, voice recordings every now and then and listen to them and go, well, that's a really nice idea. That's really good. And then a lot of them you just discard because they're rubbish. But, you know, there are moments that you just capture.
I mean, yeah, I mean, you're saying you're going back and discovering stuff. Perhaps there is a point in going back and reworking now that we're a little bit more mature, shall we say, and a little bit older, and perhaps getting something at least as a launch pad for a new idea.
You do. And I think that comes, I mean, one of the great things about doing music is that you have different periods in your creative life. I'm getting, you know, I'm a bit older now, obviously, than I used to be. We all are older than we used to be. That's a daft thing to say. But the principle of it is that when you're younger, you have less theoretical knowledge of music as a musician. You don't know so much. So you play some chords, you sing some melodies, and it's generally dreadful, and you learn and you pick up some new bits. But every now and then you'll write something that's a little bit half decent. You'll go, oh, that was good, yeah. And it sits in a folder. And then when you go back to it years later with the experience of all the theoretical knowledge and everything you do, you go back and you hear something in that music that you wouldn't write now, but you hear something that you wrote when you were younger, and you can then take your elder self and work it up into what you think would now be right. And I've done that. You know, some pieces I write, they come really quickly, and they are just bang, 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 and you write them, and you're doing an album at the time. If it's perfectly, they come out. Other pieces sit there for 10, 15 years before they get finished. And that's what I love about doing it is that every song's different, every story's different, every piece of music has a different gestation period, and you never know. You never know when it's going to be right.
to be honest with you, if I went back and visited some of the stuff that I wrote on three chords at 15 paeons to girl, why don't nice girls like me? You know, that sort of stuff. I think there's a best left in the folder, if not burnt outright, to be honest with you, Oliver.
Right. Teenage diary stuff.
Honestly, woe is me. Was the plan to take this on tour? Were you ever going to go out with this on tour before COVID?
Before COVID, yeah. I did, I used to do the first two albums I used to do with my own band. We used to do some of the tracks. We've never taken it out from start to finish. And Clive and I did talk about this. We said, you know, once this is all over, maybe we will go out and do a show or two of the whole thing from start to finish. But it's quite complex. There's quite a lot of people involved. And we just, you know, nobody knows really what the live market is going to be yet. We are starting to come out of the lockdowns, but as much as everybody suddenly goes, we can get back to normal, we just don't know yet. And you don't know what, it's all very well saying, yeah, we're going to go out and do tours and do stuff. But there's still a sort of level of apprehension from people of, am I going to go and sit in a theatre? Am I going to stand next to somebody I don't know for 2 hours? You know, people aren't quite sure yet. I think until we sort of really have an understanding about how live music is going to work, everybody's a little bit trepidatious about it at the moment. They're not quite sure. So we're sort of going to test, see how it goes and see what happens. But we're in no major rush, but it's something we'd like to do.
Mm. So, I mean, if somebody's coming to your music for the first time, how would you describe what they're going to experience I've already played one track off and then we're going to sign out with Coming to Town, but how should they approach your music? If that's not a loaded question.
With an open mind and a smile on their face, that's the way to do it. How do you describe what you do? I mean, I write music in all sorts of different styles, and I like to think that there's people out there that like everything I do, and there's some people that will pick on a certain style that I do. Like, in this box set, there's pieces on there that are quite heavy guitar stuff with soaring guitar. So there's other pieces that are a bit Broadway, which is piano and just voice, and then there's pieces in between. So, you know, the chances are people will find something in there that they enjoy. If you like keyboard-based rock music that has light and shade and has a little bit more than just your traditional three chords, verse, chorus, then you'll probably enjoy it. If you like that sort of style of music, think War of the Worlds, think stuff like that, think Floyd, think any of those classic bands that influence musicians like me. That's if you come into it with that sort of mindset, you'll probably like it. And if you don't like any of that stuff, come and join anyway, because you might like it anyhow.
There you go. That's solid to me. Now, we're doing this interview, as we do these days, on Zoom. And unfortunately, the audience can't actually see this. But Oliver is actually the best dressed interviewer I've ever done, because he's wearing a rather fetching... And I just noticed the shirt as well, which is rather... So you swan around Cheltenham like that normally on a Friday afternoon, I must congratulate you on your sartorial elegance.
Well, thank you very much. I mean, yes, this is my usual, hanging around the house attire. You know, I do have a nice red velvet jacket upstairs, but I thought that was a bit overdressed. Now, I mean, as I said before, you never know when you're doing an interview on Zoom, you never know whether it's actually, you know, a live video as well. So you sort of, every now and then, I just sort of think to myself, better just put a jacket on. But the shirt, I will say, is my standard attire. I generally have a collection of shirts which are slightly less than standard, I think that's the nicest way of doing it. If I look at a shirt in a shop and go, that's a bit weird, I generally pick it up, and I live with those quite regularly.
Excellent. I think we have the same tailor. And also, being a petrol head as well, I couldn't fail to notice the fine collection of motor models behind you as well.
Yeah, I mean, this room really is a man cave. It's full of keyboards, multiple guitars, model cars, and lovely books and CDs. I mean, it's just, you know, I come in here and sometimes I don't do any work. I just sit on my swivel chair and go, oh, things, lovely boy.
That's basically my radio career, basically, in a sentence. Just sit on a swivel chair and go, lovely to everything. If people,
yeah, I keep trying to find the next set of cars I want to get, but I'm a bit of a Jaguar fan, so they're mostly Jags up there. They're a couple of Aston Martins.
Yeah, well, we will. Aston Martin now apparently an F1, though. Let's not even go there. If people want to find more information about you or go check out the entire opus of Olivia Wakeman, where can they go?
I've got my main website, which is oliverwakeman.co.uk. So that's the first port of call. That way you can test the water by reading some of the bits that I write and sort of go, this guy's a lunatic, I don't want anything to do with him, or actually, he sounds quite interesting, I'd be interested in learning more. So that's always a good starting point. And a lot of the records are now available on burningshed.com, which is a label, record label run. They call it a label run by artists for artists. So it is always done with the musician and the artist first, which is thinking about the packaging and making sure whatever is released to the public is a really quality product. It's not just a record label shoving out something in the cheapest possible packaging for the highest possible price. It's always a really nice product, which is why I like working with them. And they were very encouraging in making sure this box set looked as good as it could possibly look.
And of course, I mean, this is what people want. They want quality. They want to get that old frisson of excitement that you don't get from just pressing download.
I think people do, actually. I think there was a bit of a change. It's happened recently. I've noticed it with a lot of people, a bit like instruments. For a while, it was just computers, just plugins, just not being able to play any instrument. And I spoke to somebody the other day, said the sales of guitars have gone up and people are starting to interact with real instruments and realize that actually you actually have to put a bit of effort in to be able to do this properly. You know, so many people can just pick stuff up in a computer and make something that sounds polished. I'm not going to say professional. They can make something sound polished, but actually being able to actually pick up an instrument and do something with it is actually something that it's a skill that people are actually beginning to go, actually, I really quite enjoy the discipline of this. And I think it's the same, you know, with music as well. People have got a bit bored of that. I've just got my iTunes folder. I mean, do you remember the old days when you used to go to a party and the first thing you do is stand there looking at the bookshelves when you weren't quite sure who everybody was or who the host was. And you look at the records and you go, oh, Supertramp, I've got that record. And you suddenly had something that you could identify with that someone else could identify with. Or you could both stand looking at this wall and go, you got any of these? And suddenly you could find a connection between you. And you would never, ever walk up to somebody in the street and say, here, have a scroll through my iTunes. Here, have my phone.
Look at my playlist. Look at my playlist.
You wouldn't do that. And I think that is... that's sad, and I think that's what's really nice about physical products actually coming back, because at the end of the day, as brilliant as technology and digital stuff is, we are still organic humans who are tactile at the end of the day. We still like to hold something, touch something, and buying a physical product and listening to something and reading about it is, I think it's quite an enjoyable experience, which is, you know, we just have so much more media now to consume them than they ever used to in the 70s when records were one of the main things. You had, what, 3 TV stations and a record player. That was all you had.
Made your own fun, as the saying goes. Well, this is from the Tales of the Gaslight 3 CD box set. It's by Oliver Wakeman and Clive Nolan. Oliver, just give us the website one more time. People want to check you out or find you on the social media. Perhaps you do an Instagram thing.
I'm on Twitter and Facebook in the usual places, which is just Oliver Wakeman. My website, oliverwakeman.co.uk, and the record is available from burningshed.com, and it's called Tales by Gaslight.
It's been great to speak to you. Stay safe, be good, and we're going to play out with Coming to Town. Making a sound.
Stop the podcast.
Stop the podcast.
Hi, everybody. Just to let you know, this episode of Fish is sponsored by TV licensing.
Yes, TV licensing. What are you watching on TV, Andy?
I have been watching a show that's called 2 Weeks in August.
Okay.
Despite it being July at the time of recording.
Oh, you don't have to watch TV shows in the time that their name references.
No, absolutely. I watched The Darling Buds of May in winter. Anyway, 2 Weeks in August. It's a really good series. It's set on a lovely Mediterranean holiday.
Ooh.
And it's a group of old mates from uni who've gathered together. Some of them have got kids. Some of them haven't. Some of them have been going through big life events. And it's one of those amazing pressure cooker series where things just get more and more and more tense.
Oh, those stressful ones.
Yeah, I love it. I love it.
I love my comedy, I gotta say. So I've been watching Android, which is Diane Morgan's new thing, and I absolutely love it. But I just, for me, I always, on television, watch everything with someone from Bolton in it. That's basically all I watch.
And she's from Bolton?
She's from Bolton.
But in this show, I believe she's a robot.
She's a robot, and it is not certain where in the country she's from.
It depends where the facility is that makes her, I suppose.
I guess so. But what are we actually here to say?
Oh, we're here to say that if you want to watch any of these shows, your TV license covers you to watch over 400 TV channels and everything on BBC iPlayer.
That is incredible.
So 2 Weeks in August has finished going out now, but you can get hold of it on the iPlayer.
If you want to find out more about this, then go to tvl.co.uk/pod.
Now back to the tension and the stress and the misery of this episode of Fish.
Oh, I thought you were referencing Bolton. On with the podcast.